everyone. This is Ron Wade. I want to welcome you all to Santa Rosa, California. We're at the Jesus Seminar. We've had an incredible weekend where I get to enjoy, about 50 to 70 New Testament scholars that have gathered here to talk about the historical Jesus, Paul, Acts, etc., etc., the New Testament. This weekend has been primarily a Paul, and today I have the great privilege of interviewing three authors of a new book called The Authentic Letters of Paul, published by Polebridge Press. The book is co-authored by Art Dewey, Roy Hoover, and Lane McGahey, who are all here. I would like very much to welcome you three gentlemen. It's really an honor and a privilege to be able to talk to you today. Roy, just tell me just a bit about who you are, where you come from, so our audience knows who you are.
Well, I'll tell you my academic connections. I have recently retired from Quitman College, where I was the Weyerhaeuser Professor of Biblical Literature and Professor of Religion. I did graduate education at Harvard University.
Thank you very much. Next, Art Dewey.
Hi. I've been at Xavier University in Cincinnati for the last 30 years, and my degree also is from Harvard. I've been very much a person from New England until I got to Ohio.
There you go. Lane, tell us about yourself, please.
Thanks, Ron. I grew up in Maine, but actually left the state when I was 18 to go to college, and I've never lived there since. My doctorate is from Vanderbilt University. I taught at the University of Montana with Bob Funk as a colleague for 12 years, and then have been the Atkinson Professor of Religion and Ethics at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon, and from 1981 until I retired in 2007.
Thank you. You really haven't retired, though. I know that.
No.
I know. You're still working at it. And you're writing a new book, too, right now. Probably all of you are writing books right now. Art, where is Xavier?
Xavier's in Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, Ohio. Yeah. Great. You know, I'd be remiss, gentlemen, and I think you would agree if I didn't acknowledge two additional motivational forces that really stand behind this amazing effort to bring a new translation to Paul's letters to the public. The first is the founder of the Jesus Seminar, which you just mentioned, Lane, Bob Funk. Robert Funk passed a number of years ago, but he started the Jesus Seminar. He was the founder, along with Lane and Roy and many, many others that are here this weekend to honor the 25th year of the Jesus Seminar. And also our friend who had passed 3 or 4 years ago, Daryl Schmidt. He was also an integral part of the initial translation of Paul. Now, second, before I get lost in the discussion where I'm going to let you take me where you want me to go, I'm going to guide the conversation just a little bit, because Paul is a very interesting character in Christianity, as we all know. For without Paul, many say we wouldn't have Christianity the way we have it now, because he brought it to the Gentiles. And in 70 AD, Jerusalem was sacked by the Romans, and maybe we hear very little about the original church. After that, we hear a lot about the Gentile church as it grew quite rapidly. First of all, you tell us that you have translated, this translation of Paul's letters is in American English. And I use your words there. It was from the book. And I think that's important, because of all the translations I've read over the many, many, many years, this was the best I've ever read. And I told you this personally beforehand. I really, really loved your translation. It makes it so readable, ladies and gentlemen. You have to get this book. You can't pass it up. And again, it's called The Authentic Letters of Paul. You say in here, I'm going to quote something, we have to be able to grasp the rhetorical diatribes. And those are, again, you explain what that means. It's quite frankly escaped me from many Paul's letters, because it's hard for a 21st century person to enter into Paul's world some 20 or 30 years after Jesus' death. Thus, to set this scene that we're about to discuss, I want to start this interview by jumping out of the chronological order of your book to your last chapter discussing the letter to the Romans. It's here, and I'm going to quote your words. You say, "It is difficult for modern readers to imagine what the early Jesus movement was like, especially before the fall of the temple in 70 of the Common Era. During Paul's time, both within and outside of Israel, there were numerous ways of being Jewish. The followers of Jesus would have still been considered a sect within the pluralism that was Second Temple Judaism." One of you, please, tell the audience, what was this world like? It wasn't 21st century. it was a different world that Paul walked into. Art.
I think we can say that we should immediately dismiss from our imaginations the cinema image of the early church. That is to say, the pastel image or the image where there's just one sort of story. It would be better to imagine an ancient marketplace and walk into the ancient marketplace, and the first thing that's going to hit you would be the smells. You'd smell garlic. You'd smell chickens. You'd smell various things, fruits and vegetables. And that's where you're going. That's right. And you'd smell humanity. And remember how the ancients washed. When you went to the bath, you didn't wash with water. You put oil on. You scraped it off. You used water to go into the pools and things like that. But then when you did that, you put oil back on. So you're smelling oil. But the other thing is you're going to hear sounds. And there's going to be a variety of sounds, and just in terms of people calling out and wanting clients and patrons and things like that. And one of the things that we've tried to suggest in these letters is that the authentic voice of Paul has to be heard within a whole range and perhaps even a cacophony of sounds. And that's one of the things that scholars have been trying to do over the last 30 years, trying to bring some perspective and some degree of determining what is the voice print of Paul, the historical Paul.
And by voice print, you mean...
Well, another way of saying it is the authentic Paul. What is the historical Paul? Can we, in fact, determine as well as we can, given the fact that the evidence is fragmentary, can we say, this is probably from Paul, this is consistently so, and this piece or that piece is perhaps not from Paul?
And we will get into that because you go into that quite a bit here, and we want people to understand, ladies and gentlemen, the scholars have read these letters very, very carefully, and they will tell you, they're about to tell you, that they don't believe that all the letters attributed to Paul were written by Paul. They were written much later, but we'll get into that. Tell us about the Christians that Paul was speaking to, and I'm using that word with quotation marks because there were the followers of the way or many other names. But he was traveling amongst the Gentiles, amongst the Greco world, in the Eastern Mediterranean. How would they have heard him? Would he have been standing in a marketplace? Would he be in a home when they first heard him talking to a group? What do
you say?
Yes,
all of the above, frankly. It depends on how you begin to imagine how he traveled. He traveled usually by foot. He would have come into a situation where if he did know someone, he'd have to find some sort of contact. If he has any connection with the Jewish population, he might, in fact, get to know the connections through that way. Another possibility would be going into the marketplace itself, especially going to a stoa, a colonnaded walkway, where the thinkers would, in fact, encounter people and they would strike up conversations. It could also be that Paul would be invited into a particular house, and after a meal, they would ask him to speak. So there are a number of possible venues.
I was going to say, Paul was largely self-supporting financially also. Mm-hmm. He practiced a trade.
Yeah.
So he would go into the marketplace and probably offer his services as a tradesman, and then encounter people in that fashion, engage them in conversation, and that would lead to other circles of conversation.
Mm-hmm. And who were these first followers of Jesus that Paul brought into the fold? What was the makeup? Did he go to the synagogues perhaps first to try to proselytize? What do we know?
Well, Wayne Meeks, a sociologist of religion at Yale, did a study of the first Christians some years ago, in which he tried to do an analysis of the social standing of the people whose names appeared in the letters of Paul. He concluded that rather than being slaves and the utter bottom of the social pyramid, these were lower middle class working people with upward aspirations that were most prominently or most consistently depicted in Paul's letters or represented in Paul's letters by their names and sometimes by the work they did.
So the image that the lower classes and the poor and the destitute were not necessarily the people Paul was talking to at this time.
Not the entire constituency. There were some people who were former slaves in the group, and no doubt there were some of the poor who would be a part of the group of people that Paul addressed. But according to Meeks, they were not the principal constituency of the hearers of Paul.
Well, although you have to situate it. There's no middle class in the ancient world. You're in the artisan class. You're in the merchant class. You're in the upper class. There's a great degree of separation between the different groups. It could very well be, though, that some of the householders were well-to-do, and they would have opened the doors to poorer people.
Prisca
and Aquila.
Yeah.
I don't know if we know that much about them. That's part of the problem. It could be for example, it could be with some of the women named. They might well have been widows, or they could have been wives. It's very hard to determine. If they were widows, they might actually have had some money.
Right. Because it records that Paul met in some of their homes, or the churches did.
Yeah, for example, in 1 Corinthians, Chloe's people. Well, Chloe is a female name.
Let's transition over a little bit and tackle the letters of Paul themselves. Most Christians assume that all the letters that are included in the New Testament, supposedly written by Paul, were written by Paul. But that just isn't true, I think you will say. Which ones are, and which ones are in, which ones are out? And how do we know they're authentic? How about you, Lane?
Well, what we've done is in this book is to try to provide the arguments and the evidence as to why only roughly a part of the letters. We argue there are seven letters in the New Testament that are attributed to Paul, were actually written by him, and that other letters that are attributed are either written by his disciples or others later on who are followers of Paul or trying to somehow nuance his message for another generation. We identify the authentic letters of Paul as being, to put them in somewhat chronological order, First Thessalonians, Galatians, First Corinthians, Second Corinthians. Those are the first four. And then we get Philippians and Philemon and Romans in that order. We've also tried to divide the authentic letters up into the individual fragments of letters that are combined in Second Corinthians and Philippians. And what that suggests is that Paul carried on an extended conversation, communication through letters with some of his churches. But when whoever it was at the end of the first century went around to the churches to collect copies, that individual then stitched together several letters that Paul might have written to a particular community, and they end up being composite letters in the New Testament. So we both tried to identify the authentic letters in order to try to recover the historical Paul, but we've also then broken up the authentic letters into their various components, that part of it. You asked the question about how we identify these. And there are various ways that one goes about that, and I would be happy to hear Art and Roy on this. My principal approach is structural. That is, I think Paul invented, based on the personal letter tradition of the Hellenistic period, he invented a unique kind of structure for his letters. And one can use that template then to sort out which letters attributed to Paul actually are written in the form in which Paul wrote his letters, and which seem to be letters that do not contain the unique marks of a Pauline letter. So that's how I begin to make the distinction between authentic letters and pseudonymous letters. Let me hear from these other fellows.
In addition to that, you'd have to look at the vocabulary. You'd have to look at, for example, how Paul speaks of Jesus, how he understands the community, what terms he uses for it. You'd also look at phrases that Paul would use. You also would have to consider, well, what is the social situation envisioned by this letter? And what you do is you really have to compare one letter with another letter, and to see, is there some degree of consistency, Or does it really fall off the map?
And with consistency, you're referring to this phraseology,
yes,
the words,
all
Greek,
of those,
Greek words
everything
he
that
uses.
I mentioned, yeah. And right. also consistency in terms of structure, too.
Yeah, but yeah. just a footnote to that. Another, I mean, it's not only are you hearing the same voice, as it were, in, mm-hmm. in letters that Paul wrote, but the same voice print, but it's also the question of anachronism.
Yeah.
Some of the letters, consistency in terms of views on particular issues. And in the second generation, the end of the first century after Paul, what we get are some letters that contain references to, let's say, organizational structures of local churches that would not have come into existence mm-hmm. with a hierarchy with bishops and elders and deacons until after Paul's time.
And there was
time.
No such thing at the time of Paul.
No.
There was no hierarchy like that.
No. You had loose communities organized around particular leaders like Paul. We call them envoys rather than using the technical term apostle.
Why did you come up with an envoy? Because apostles has a certain meaning in Christendom. I mean, the original 12 apostles.
Right.
Then
right.
Paul counts himself as one equal to them at later and untimely birth.
Well,
envoy just means a messenger.
Well, I think what that does is call attention to Paul's self-perception as someone to whom a certain mission had been entrusted, rather than an apostle who that conveys to the modern reader, somebody who was appointed with a certain authority. Now, Paul does have authority, but it's not ecclesiastical authority. It's his sense of having been called to his mission directly by God. So envoy, we think, conveys Paul's own self-conception better than the term apostle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing is that we have avoided simple transliteration. For example, we do not use the word Christ for Christos. We use the word anointed or God's anointed. The same thing with apostle. Apostolos.
It's a Greek word.
It's a Greek word. And all you've done is to put the Greek into English without actually translating it. And so therefore, the translator has to go back and say, what does it actually mean?
Right. And we had a great discussion up here. If you've never been to a Jesus seminar, folks, look up Jesus seminar, Google it. You'll see that we meet twice a year. In the spring and the fall, and it's sheer joy. If you love the Bible, if you love the New Testament, that's what we talk about up here, and everyone is welcome, so please, please come. All right. Now, we're talking about a time frame, which is fascinating because a lot of people don't get the chronology of the Bible, or rather they use the chronological order the way the books are included in the New Testament, and they assume that Paul comes later. In actual fact, Paul is the first writings we have from the early church to tell us what the early church was about. Somebody help me out here and tell me about how this all came about, the chronological order. Who was first?
Well, it has to do with the construction of what was later called a Bible. And we really don't get Bibles as such until about the 4th century. First of all, we have scrolls. And the scrolls become codices, which are nothing but papyrus that you fold over, and then you stitch and put a cover on it. That's your first book. And we get codices, and they were used by Jesus' followers in the 2nd century. But we don't have anything really official until later than that. And it's in the 4th century that we really get Bibles. And that means collections of disparate materials put together in one volume. And that was through principally through the influence and orders of Constantine.
I was just going to follow up, Ron, on this comment in terms of chronology. The fact that, of course, the Gospels were put at the beginning of the New Testament owes to the fact that they focus on Jesus. And Jesus lived before Paul. And so, say, Matthew is put first, not because it's the earliest Gospel, but because those who put together the Bible that I was talking about assumed that it was the most Jewish of the Gospels and wanted to put it next to the Hebrew Bible. So the books are not in chronological order, is the point, both neither the Gospels nor the letters of Paul. And the fact is, Jesus, so far as we know, didn't write anything. The Gospels are not written by Jesus. They're books written about Jesus by others later on. And so chronologically, Jesus was crucified. somewhere around 30. Paul's letters probably date to somewhere around 50. They're the earliest writings in the New Testament. And then we don't get any of the Gospels until sometime around the fall of Jerusalem in 70, between 70 and the beginning of the second century. So if one is going to, is one interested in the historical development of early Christianity, you have to begin with the letters of Paul before you then go turn to the Gospels and see how the second generation was interpreting the tradition about Jesus.
Correct. And now we have around 50 to 60.
Yeah.
We have Paul writing these letters. He's starting churches. He's walking all over the Eastern Mediterranean. And he's starting little groups here and there, and he speaks to them through his letters mostly. He stays with them, and he goes from place to place, and then he writes letters. Most of these letters are not about Jesus, but they're about the church. They're about maybe the belief that he has or the telling about Jesus, and it's the risen Jesus that he has seen. He is very clear. Paul never met Jesus in his life.
No,
never did.
No, he didn't.
Right. No. And the Jesus that he knew, he often says several places here, is not the physical Jesus. He's not really interested that much in him. You don't find him telling him stories about what Jesus said or did. That's for the other followers that were in Jerusalem. So how did he get started at this? Let's go to that visionary experience when we hear from Acts that he was on his way to Damascus. And there was a vision, and he was blind or deaf, or he saw it, and others did see it or didn't see it, did hear it. And then he spoke to an early follower or several early followers in Damascus, and from there he took off on his own. But that's not what Paul says. Help me out. What does Paul say about his own life?
That's right. The best information we have is found in Galatians, and we have a little bit in Philippians, but the most specific information we have is that Paul had what he would call an insight or a breakthrough. In Greek, it's an apokalypsis. And that meant that he had a new understanding of what? What we've come to conclude is that he had a new understanding of what God had done to Jesus. And that Paul saw this not as a conversion experience, but he saw this in terms, at least he describes it in terms of a prophetic call. So in one sense, Paul is reiterating his Jewish roots, and he's saying that this breakthrough is giving him an insight of what this God of Israel has done to this Jesus, and he sees this, that there's a purpose to this, namely he is to go to the nations, to the non-Jews. And this is all part of one sentence, that he sees himself as a prophet giving this vision to others, to the non-Jews.
Well, you see, and when I look back at that event, momentous event of conversion for him.
I would be careful about the word conversion.
That's my word.
It's your word, but it might not be Paul. It's certainly not Paul's word.
Okay. I think the expression that Paul had a change in his religious orientation is a more descriptive way to talk about the change in direction and in a sense of identity, which Paul came away from that revelatory experience and which he claimed, as Art said, he uses the term, he's really defending the gospel he has been preaching and claiming its authenticity. Mm-hmm. And he says, I didn't learn this from any group of human beings. I didn't learn it at school. There's no human authority figure who taught me this. I received it via an apocalypsis to Jesu Christu in Greek, a revelation or an apocalypse of Jesus the Anointed. We translate that term apocalypse as a special insight from God. So if Paul had a visionary experience that he's referring to there, he's also talking about seeing with his understanding, not just a matter of visual sight. Mm-hmm. Something dawned on him. We sometimes describe it as a large aha moment in which Paul grasped something for the first time and saw its implications. Mm-hmm. And that's where he starts his theologizing and his explication of his message.
May I follow up on this? Because I think this is one of the key issues in looking at Paul. It has to do with what happened to Paul. It turned him from being a missionary for the Pharisees, persecuting followers of Jesus into a missionary for the anointed. And it goes to the problem that the Hebrew prophets had already been struggling with back as far as 2 Isaiah. Mm-hmm. How can one, 2 Isaiah advocates the notion that of monotheism, that there's only one God, and that God is the God of all peoples, not just of the Jews. And at the, one of the problems that prophets beginning with 2 Isaiah struggle with and that Paul is dealing with is how can you both claim that there's only one God of all people and yet claim that somehow the Jews enjoy a special relationship with this God and that that the nations or non-Jews do not have access to the universal God. And so a way of, I think, characterizing Paul's aha moment or insight is that what the faithfulness of Jesus represents for Paul is now a way by which non-Jews, the term we use for Gentiles is the nations, by which the nations can have the same kind of access to God through the faithfulness of Jesus that Jews have had through the Mosaic, the covenant of Moses. And that allows Paul then to begin to reconcile the disparity between the claim that there is only one God of all peoples and the notion that that the Jews are important in the sense that they have had they've had this special relationship with God, but now through Jesus this access to the divine has been made available to everyone. Now that becomes an important issue, particularly in Romans, because it has to do with what was probably the biggest philosophical problem in this period, the so-called theodicy problem. That is the question as to whether God is righteous, the righteousness of God. Because the sort of argument that was being, the objection, one of the objections made to Paul, interestingly, in his claims, has to do with the fact that if you introduce Jesus, the Anointed One, as now a means for access to the divine, doesn't that mean that somehow God is inconsistent or not trustworthy? He's somehow nullified the old arrangement through the covenant with Moses and replaced it with something new. And so throughout Romans, Paul is trying to argue that it's that the fact that now God has made it possible through the faithfulness of Jesus for non-Jews to have access to the divine, that does not represent an inconsistency or a change of mind on the part of God. But that there is here now God, as it were, being consistent, but at the same time making it possible for Gentiles to have that relationship through the faithfulness of Jesus.
Yeah, I think you can say that it's not that God changes the divine mind. It's rather Paul has a paradigm shift in how he sees God. And it's crucial to see that Paul really is very Jewish here, that his real focus is not on Jesus, but actually on what God has done for
Jesus.
Correct. And that's a very important thing.
You know, I'm going to drag you back kicking and screaming, because I really do think that people want to know about this man. And I think there's some misconceptions. First of all, Paul didn't start preaching right away, at least to our knowledge. And he didn't go directly to Jerusalem and say, I've had my aha moment. It was a couple of years later, and then he makes a point to say only met with two, Cephas, Peter, and James, brother of Jesus. Whatever happened, he took off for Arabia. We don't hear anything about him, and he doesn't talk about his stint in Arabia. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, he's in Arabia early on.
Three years.
During the time between he had this aha moment, and when he made his first trip to Jerusalem, mm-hmm. he says that was 3 years later. But it was in that three-year period that he went to Arabia.
And then where?
And then from his 2 weeks as Peter's house guest in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. presumably he goes up north to Antioch. The next time we see him, he's at the Christian community or the Jesus followers group in Antioch.
Mm-hmm. Galatians 2:1-10.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And you're right to say that we don't know very much about that period of time. We only begin to know something in more detail about Paul from Paul himself once he launches out into an itinerary of visits to cities in the Roman province of Asia and then on the mainland of Europe. Mm-hmm. When he goes to Galatia, and then he goes to Philippi across the Aegean Sea, to Corinth, to Thessalonica, and then on to Corinth. Then we can track Paul at that period when he is away from Antioch and heading to the western part of the empire.
Do you think this was just as simple as for the next 12 years he was getting his act together? He was learning about his own. I mean, he had to talk to people to kind of refine his message.
I think that's very hard to say. We're really doing conjectures about that.
Oh, I know you guys hate that.
We don't have information.
Right.
My hunch is that Paul had begun to get some things clear from the beginning of that aha moment. When you have a moment like that, important things become clear to you. Yes, you want to work at what the implications of that moment are, but my guess is that he had a pretty clear idea about what his mission was very early on, and circumstances in part may have determined where he was active. For example, in Antioch, we know that he had a public dispute with Simon Peter about, what shall we say, whether Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians could properly eat together. Was that a violation of Jewish kosher food laws, which continue to be important for some, or not? And it was after that confrontation that he heads to the major cities of the empire on his own, apart from Barnabas, with whom he'd been associated earlier.
So they kind of split.
There was evidently a kind of a split
resulting that
came out of that controversy in Antioch.
And it's not clear that Paul won that. In fact, I would argue just the reverse, that since he never mentions whether he won, he probably lost that argument and left.
That's right.
Was kicked out of the community at that point, or made not welcome in the other group.
He probably didn't persuade. He didn't persuade the people at Antioch.
Right. But they didn't seem to argue at that time, at least, about circumcision. Was that pretty a settled issue by then for the Gentiles?
Paul has to continue, has several times to argue against people who want to claim that circumcision is the sign of the only valid covenant people have with God, mm-hmm. and therefore is required of all those who became affiliated with the new religious community that Paul was advocating. So Paul has a serious argument about whether that's the case or not. Mm-hmm. His view is circumcision no longer means anything. If you're circumcised or uncircumcised, it makes no difference. You're all one in Jesus as God's anointed in this new era. After the gospel, which we have translated God's world-changing news, because we think there Paul is using a term that's current in political propaganda in the Roman Empire, and that's what it is. That's what the Caesars have done, especially Augustus has done, to change the world for the better. Paul thinks Jesus, as the anointed, has changed the world for the better.
Right.
And that's the great message he's taking.
Mm-hmm. Right. I need to go back just a hair for our audience, because our audience I can hear sitting out there saying, yeah, but this isn't what Acts says. Acts has a lot of information about Paul, and you've ignored all of this. So tell me about the book of Acts.
Well, let me begin, Ron, with some comments on that. The conclusion that the Acts seminar here at Westar has come to is that the book of Acts was probably not written until sometime early in the second century.
And that's fairly recent change from late
it's
first
a recent
century.
Change. Axe used to be dated to the 90s, and right. Our colleagues have argued that it probably was not written until sometime around 120. Joe Tyson and others in this seminar. That means that we have decided that what is going on in the book of Acts is a reinterpretation of Paul in light of a controversy around Marcion that is taking place at that time.
Tell us who Marcion is. You can't throw those out here.
Well, Marcion is the first Christian to try to put together a collection of books that later would be called the New Testament. And his New Testament contained some perhaps edited versions of some of Paul's letters and of the Gospel of Luke. And that's probably the earliest version we have of the New Testament.
So you could say one gospel and one apostle.
One gospel
was
Marcion's and one apostle.
Canon.
Yeah. And Marcion had what one would
and
call...
And which gospel did he use?
Luke.
Yeah.
Marcion also had from our point of view, misinterpreted Paul as sort of rejecting Judaism. And so the argument is that that Paul is a Jew and he's not rejecting Judaism. And that to that extent, Marcion's view of Paul is mistaken. But what Paul has done, to go back to what Roy was saying about circumcision, he's not rejecting circumcision. In our view, he's simply arguing that it is a mark of religious identity or a conventional religious custom that is still important for Jews, but is not the basis for the access of the nations to God. So you get that kind of issue. So we recommend in the book that readers do not use the information, the narrative, as it were, about Paul in Acts as the basis for reconstructing his life and his missionary work.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add a comment to that? And so to supplement what Lane has just said, which I think is basically right, another reversal of previous scholarly opinion about Acts is that prior to the work of the Acts seminar, most of us had been schooled in the view and had accepted the view that Acts had access to independent, reliable historical information about Paul and did not rely upon Paul's letters for his information because he never mentions them, the author of Acts. That has been virtually completely reversed. And the Acts seminar has now made arguments to pointing toward the conclusion that Luke, in writing Acts, is very dependent upon the information he finds in Paul's letters and has very little information about Paul that's independent from Acts. So that's a complete reversal of judgment about where Luke, in writing Acts, got his information.
Is that a minority among the scholars still?
I would say that among Acts scholars, many of them would argue for that. But if you were to say, what about New Testament scholars, you'd have to break it up into some people who do not want to even rethink the question of the location and the dating of Acts. So more traditional scholars would argue that's first, but they simply assume that to be the case.
Gentlemen, I am watching the clock on a little long. May I ask, would you be willing to stand by, and I've got to end this session right now, but we spend just a few more minutes and we'll do a second session, and it'll be the following week. So folks, ladies and gentlemen, I see them nodding, some unwilling, some willing, that they'll stay a few minutes longer. So that means you're going to have to tune in next week and get the next podcast. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. This has been a very informative session, and now that I've got you trapped in our hotel room, you can't leave. And the door is locked. And we're going to start this all over again. Thank you, everybody, for being with us today. It has been a real joy being with you. Next week, you will have the second installment. For now, take care.